This is the Hockey News Podcast.
Hello, everybody out there in internet's land. Welcome to the Hockey News Podcast. Today, I'm Edward Fraser, your fill-in host for Matt Larkin, who is playing the role of analyst today, sitting to my right. To my left, Ryan Kennedy. Ken is off on assignment, so we won't have to listen to him today.
Yay!
Poor Ken.
Sorry, Ken.
Ken is off in Pittsburgh covering the Ottawa Penguins series, getting us a nice editor's story coming back, which will be a good one for the next issue. But today we're going to talk about the playoffs, and to me, both these series have been fascinating so far for different reasons. Let's start with the Penguins series, and let's start with the most prevalent name in that series, Sidney Crosby. He's played five games since he's been back from his concussion, 3 points, none of which have been goals. Is something off with Sidney Crosby, Matt?
I think there is, and I think that it's no secret what's going on. I think he probably came back a little bit too soon. It kind of reminds me of the way the Leafs described Nikita Zaitsev. It was a really scary quote from Mike Babcock when he said, you know, he wasn't necessarily 100%, but he was playoff ready, talking about a concussion. That's freaky, and I think that might have been what's going on with Pittsburgh. Crosby obviously champing at the bit to come back. And he may have come back a little bit early. I don't know if he's still feeling symptoms, even if he's not. Maybe he's physically just a little tentative, because what people don't understand, it's not just about the symptoms. It's also second impact syndrome. It's the fear of getting hit again, because if you get hit too close together, two brain traumas too close together, that's how you trigger the second impact syndrome. So I'm starting to wonder if it's affecting Sid's play. And, you know, you don't want to ever call him invisible, but he's less visible. You know, he had 4 goals, 11 points in 7 games, pre-concussion, and no goals, like you said, at no goals, 3 points in 5 games. I don't think that's a coincidence at all. And it could change the face of the series to me, because what the big advantage for Pittsburgh was going in was they had the two elite centers, which meant that Erik Karlsson was going to have to sit for half the game, and that means the rest of that airspace could be filled with, say, Evgeny Malkin if he's against the Crosby line. But if Crosby's neutralized and not himself, then maybe you start playing Karlsson against Malkin and suddenly the series becomes more even.
But, I mean, watching Sid play and watching how much he got banged up in his return game, he's not playing soft. He's not avoiding contact.
No, I feel that perhaps this is a small sample size in terms of the dip in production. It's also important to remember that these past couple of games have been very important games, mm-hmm. including a Game 7 against the Washington Capitals.
And the Capitals upped their game.
They certainly did. They played a really good game. They couldn't get it done. And I think one of the reasons Sidney Crosby still is the best in the game is because he can kill you on the score sheet, but he can also play that great two-way game. And, I mean, Ottawa, full credit to the Sens in Game 1, they really just mucked up the middle of the ice and made it a very drab game if you're not an Ottawa fan, but it was effective. And I think what we're going to see from here on out is obviously Pittsburgh making adjustments, and I totally see what you're saying, Matt, about Malkin. I wouldn't be surprised if Pittsburgh coach Mike Sullivan maybe institutes some sort of strategy where Malkin is the sort of quote-unquote go-to guy, and Crosby, maybe his job is just to sort of keep Karlsson a bit in check. Maybe it's to make sure that Bobby Ryan doesn't have as much space as he has, you know, in the past couple of series, because obviously Bobby Ryan is having a great postseason run. Maybe we're just going to see a more defensive Sid because it helps the Penguins more.
So we've got both key players for each team in this series injured to one degree or another. Uh-huh. Which of these two injuries is more concerning if you're a fan of that team? Erik Karlsson, who, a little bit gimpy, but still effective. Crosby, you know, maybe not as effective, but still having an influence on the game.
It's tough, and I guess I'm going to straddle the fence and be a wimp here, but I think on one hand, Carlson's is more impactful because Ottawa needs Karlsson. It's going to sound bad to Pittsburgh fans. Ottawa needs Karlsson a lot more than Pittsburgh needs Crosby. I'm not dissing Crosby. I'm just saying you have a good team other than Crosby.
That's 100%.
Okay, everybody? Yeah. But obviously, Karlsson is the center, so he's the engine that completely drives their game. You see it in the possession numbers. When he's off the ice, it's a complete difference in terms of the flow of the game, where the puck goes, where the shot attempts go. So it's scarier in that sense that Ottawa needs him more. But in terms of the actual injury, I think Crosby's a scarier because you just don't know what you're dealing with concussions. And and it's funny, like, I tweet a lot about it because I've said before I'm a sufferer of the same syndrome, the concussion syndrome. People have said, Are you a doctor? But the point is, even doctors right now, concussions,
It's not a science that has been mastered.
You don't know.
People don't know. And there's some evidence that concussions, the symptoms can vanish within like 1 minute of impact, and something can, you can go and have an MRI or a CAT scan, mm-hmm. and the symptoms, they go away quickly. It's just so mysterious. So with Sid out there right now, I don't think he even knows exactly what's going on in his own brain, and we have no idea if he's one hit away from the end of a career or if he'll be fine and he'll score a hat trick in the next game. I just have no idea.
I was surprised when I saw him in his return game playing with such reckless abandon, because, you know, and he's got a couple of shots to the head, including that high stick, and you're right, you don't know even the smallest tap, especially when you're coming so far close to the previous concussion. I mean, it is scary, and I know me, maybe I'm just not built to be a hockey player, I couldn't go out there and throw myself around knowing that if I was to do so and to suffer another concussion, it could have not just a short-term impact, but something that goes on for years, which is very different from Erik Karlsson, who essentially isn't going to do any further damage, but is just, you know, has to play through pain with his injuries. Mm-hmm. So do you feel differently about the impact of the injuries to either of these two?
I think Karlsson is a more clear-cut loss if he were to go down for Ottawa. Interesting, just to double back on Crosby for a second. Once he did come back and reporters asked him, like, too soon, Sid? He was saying, like, look, nobody knows my body better than I do at this point. I've gone through this a lot. So it's interesting, and you're right, Matt. I mean, once you get one concussion, things really kind of open up in that respect. But with Karlsson, it's just like, if he's not there, it feels like so much of Ottawa's offense goes out the window. Their ability to transition just kind of like dies. And, you know, as I've said, I mean, players like Bobby Ryan have had a fantastic run. I thought Kyle Turris has played very well, but Karlsson is just so important to that team. And they don't have a Malkin to Karlsson's Crosby. You know, like Cody Ceci's not going to start playing like 32 minutes a game and, you know, wing passes from behind his own net right onto, you know, Kyle Turris' stick.
Like, things that have scientists in awe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're not going to break things down like we do in Erik Karlsson.
The Cody Ceci, you know, pass.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they're almost kind of similar in a way where, like, we don't know what would push Karlsson over the edge in terms of his foot injuries. Sure. I mean, like, what if he steps onto the ice funny? Could that be enough to knock him out for the rest of the series? It's tough to say. I mean, we've heard there are hairline fractures. How bad are they? Is that the extent of it? Was Karlsson underselling it or overselling it? I mean, in terms of playoff injury subterfuge, it feels like we know more about Erik Karlsson than we do for most players.
That's very odd, yeah.
He's so honest to a fault.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, I mean, frankly, like, his feet are constantly in danger, whether it's, like, from the skating or blocking shots or guys taking wax at him. So I think there's a real danger there with Karlsson, as there is with Crosby in his head. But should one team lose one of those guys, I think Ottawa would be more damaged.
Is Ottawa scared? To me, they were much more passive in that game than at any other time during the playoffs. I mean, this isn't Boucher's system from his Tampa days, but it seemed a lot more like that. They were dropping back in that 1-3-1 and building that wall a lot more, which to me, yeah, kudos, they won the game. But, you know, I don't know if that can last throughout the entire series. Do they fear the Penguins more than they've worried about their other opponents throughout the playoffs?
I don't know. I think it's more this is the way they play under Boucher. Like, if Boucher was an artist, it's like that movie Pleasantville. It's like if he saw color, he'd be like, everyone, we're going to paint everything gray. Like, it's just that's the way they play, and I think they've been pretty consistent in that sense. I personally don't see fear in the Senators because they have nothing to fear because they have nothing to lose. They're the team that, in a way, a big contender who's expected to win could suddenly start to fear because Ottawa's playing with absolute house money right now. The only situation in which I would see Ottawa suddenly starting to get scared would be if they reach the final and they draw Nashville, who's like, yeah, we're even bigger under now. Then that changes things, right? But for now, I don't know. I think this is what we've seen from Ottawa throughout the playoffs. They're not exciting to watch unless Karlsson has the puck on his stick. They grind, they slow the game down, which is a good countermeasure. It's sort of an opposite force to what Pittsburgh does, because Pittsburgh is more about up-tempo, I think. So it's sort of two different forces, and it's a matter of who's going to overpower the other.
It was absolutely effective in Game 1, and I almost wonder now, after being suffocated in Game 1, does Pittsburgh get a bit of the fear?
Well, I think that Pittsburgh's going to make adjustments, and that'll be the intriguing thing to see for the rest of the series. But I think with Ottawa, I don't think they fear the Penguins so much as they have caution about the Penguins. This is a team that can clearly burn you with speed.
Healthy fear like I fear a bear.
Exactly. This is like a mountain lion seeing a bear, and you're sort of like, I probably can't take him in normal circumstances, but maybe if I jumped on the bear's head or something. I don't know how the animal kingdom works. But I think that was the game that Ottawa needed to play. Like, they're outskilled. Mm-hmm. We know that. I mean, that's no offense to the Senators. Again, with the exception of Erik Karlsson, they're more of a, like, score-by-committee lunch pail. Like, play within Guy Boucher's system and do things on the defensive side of the puck and be structurally sound. Like, that's how they got here. That's what's going to get them to the next round if they can get to the next round. So they don't want to open things up. This is how they have to play if they want to win. And, you know, it might not be the most fun to watch, but I can guarantee you that Ottawa fans will be fine if they win, you know, 4 of 7 games by a 2-1 margin.
I hate to say it, but I'm rooting against Ottawa just for that reason.
For the copy? I was thinking that the same. Yeah, if they win the Stanley Cup, next year will be horrible.
Yeah.
Because copycat teams will just...
A Pittsburgh win is better for the game. Better for the sport. Yeah.
To me, think about one more note about Ottawa being scared or not scared. To me, the fact that a team can be 6-1 in overtime is a testament, in my mind, to not being afraid. And I know that's an intangible type of analysis.
No, you play loose, I get it.
Yeah, if you play loose, and I find the team that plays to win, doesn't sit back, and is willing to just take chances and go for it, especially you often win a game early in overtime doing that, and I think Ottawa's done that throughout the playoffs.
Game 1 in the East was absolutely a grind, probably not the most entertaining hockey. The West, the complete opposite. It's been fascinating hockey for me. Sloppy at times, but sloppy hockey and poor goaltending makes for entertainment. And Nashville did not get good goaltending in Game 2. Are we at all worried that these are cracks starting to show in Pekka Rinne's armor, or is this a one-game kind of anomaly?
I think that there is some worry here with Pekka Rinne. He's been the second best goaltender in both games, even though Nashville won in double overtime in Game 1. I thought John Gibson was really good then. And Game 2, you know, Gibson did enough to win, even though it wasn't his best performance. Rinne was not good at all, particularly on the game winner from Nick Ritchie. And, I mean, perhaps we're at a situation here where, you know, the Ducks are getting good scoring opportunities and they have the shooters to get it done. It's kind of funny because you look at Chicago and St. Louis before that, and, I mean, those teams are good shooters as well, but it just didn't work for whatever reason. Rinne was on his game, and the defense in Nashville, obviously very good. But we've seen bad Pekka Rinne in the recent past, and if bad Pekka Rinne comes back, then that's really tough for the Predators.
Bad Pekka Rinne could really change the series in a hurry.
Yeah.
But I'm going to play devil's advocate, even though I'm not exactly a Rinne apologist. I've been sort of pointing out bad Pekka Rinne for a year or two. But in these playoffs, if you think of the sample size as the playoffs, even if you're on fire, you still are going to have a bad game just once every 10 games because it's the NHL. And I compare it to Marc-Andre Fleury, who's definitely, quote-unquote, back in these playoffs. And yet, he had a really bad Game 6 against Washington. What does he do in Game 7? Shuts them out. So good Marc-Andre Fleury is still trumping bad Marc-Andre Fleury, despite the fact that bad Marc-Andre Fleury showed up for one game to be like, hey, everybody, I'm not done. And I think Pekka Rinne, I'm going to give him another shot. I think if he's bad in Game 3, then it's time to sound the alarm bells. But for the most part, he's been really good rebound control, and he's good at moving the puck, and he's in sync with that defense core. They break out of the zone so well together. I like the way he's looked playing in that team system. So I'm going to give him one more shot before I start ragging on him.
I love the communication that Rinne has had with his defenseman, specifically Subban. Like, they're in constant talking, and I think that's key for the goaltending and within that system especially. Does Nashville, if Rinne isn't A+, if he just finds his B game or his B+ game, does Nashville even have a chance in this series?
I don't know, because to me, this series was razor thin, the margin. I had it going 7 games, and I still think you're seeing the Kessler effect, the Getzlaff effect. That's the big advantage Anaheim had going in, and they're showing it in the series up the middle. Ryan Johansson, obviously Kessler's already in his head, so it's happening, just as we suspected. So I think Nashville's got to be just as good as it was in every category in the first 2 rounds to win this series. So medium Pekka Rinne, I don't think so. It sounds like a type of cheese.
Medium pecorino.
Can I get pecorino?
Can I get a pound of medium Rene? Yeah.
He should be a spokesman for pecorino, though. Pecorino? Come on.
What is pecorino?
Oh, come on. Foodies out there. It's a great cheese.
Have you?
No.
Okay.
I'm a basic person.
Yeah, and as a proud vegan, I wouldn't know what that is.
Oh, of course.
So.
I forgot. Okay.
Cheese comes in yellow and orange.
Or both, if it's marble.
That's right.
Your thoughts on the Predator's ability to overcome a subpar Rene and still win this series?
Yeah, I think you need good to very good Rene to win this because, I mean, John Gibson's a pretty acclaimed young goaltender in his own right. And because of the weapons the Ducks can throw out there and because they can do it with some pretty nice depth, I don't think you can get away with, you know, going chance for chance with them, especially if Rene's not at the top of his game.
There's no fragility to John Gibson, is there, anymore? Like, he's able to give up goals and bounce right back. He's able to have a bit of an off game and bounce right back, whereas I didn't get that feeling. He worried me before. I don't get the sensation of him being... He's seasoned now, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a player that has seen pressure throughout his career. I mean, he's got a World Junior gold, and then that same year he played at the World Championship and helped Team USA get bronze. Was a very young team, but he was as good, if not better, at the Worlds than he was at the World Juniors, and he was the MVP of the World Juniors. So I think what we're seeing here is a player that is sort of hitting his peak of NHL powers. His save percentage has gotten better every year he's been in the NHL, if you don't count like the first year where he played three games. But he's trending in the right direction, and I think he's got the right sort of like laid-back demeanor, but he marries that with an on-ice style that is obviously very effective. And that's what you want in a goaltender. You want that Carey Price character that... you know, doesn't get rattled. If they
that
have
really
a big game, that's okay.
Permeates through the team, eh? Like, that sort of confidence really just kind of trickles up through the defense to the forwards when you know you're not having to protect your goaltender.
It's so true. And the thing with John Gibson is, for some people, because he plays in a relatively obscure hockey market, it's like, oh, who is this young John Gibson who came onto the scene? But if you asked us here a few years ago, we'd say, oh, John Gibson, he's the prodigy guy. He was our number two overall prospect. If you read Hockey News Future Watch, where we rank every prospect in the NHL, 2 or 3 years ago, I think it was 3 years ago, Gibson was number two overall in the entire NHL. So he's just becoming what he was always supposed to be. He was always projected to be a star number one goaltender. And to me, the turning point, and I'm going to give credit to Ken, it was Ken that pointed this out, but the transition from Game 6 to Game 7 against the Oilers, Gibson was very bad in Game 6. But you know, he was quite bad, and the goals were very much his fault. You know, getting spread, like his 5-0 was very susceptible. And there are two ways you can bounce back from that game, or two ways you can come back physically. You either flourish, or it gets in your head and you struggle. And he obviously was great in Game 7, so he seems to have found himself, and he passed a major test.
Ducks have a lot of off-season decisions to make. You know, they've got so many quality defensemen. Lindholm, Vatanen, Fowler, Manson likely means that they're going to choose to protect four of those guys, which means they're going to have to expose a prominent forward, likely Jacob Silverberg, in the expansion draft. Is that an indication that this is the Ducks' year? Is this the make-and-break year? Are they going to lose a little bit of their edge, which is already razor-thin in a tough Pacific division? So is this the Ducks' year? If they have to win this year, or they basically have kind of missed their window?
I certainly think this is their best chance, particularly with the vintage Ryan Getzlaff we've seen this entire playoff run and going back to the season, you know, because he's getting into those sort of twilight years. Same with Corey Perry. They do have some nice young players coming up, but you're going to have to work those guys into the lineup. And for me, it's really tough. Like, man, like Jacob Silverberg, like losing him for nothing, which is essentially what's happening with the expansion draft.
I think they'll trade him, but...
That's a good thought, because... My other thinking was like, man, do you have to maybe expose one of those defensemen instead? Do you risk losing like a Josh Manson, who I know is a Matt Larkin favorite, knowing that you have a young Shea Theodore who's still finding his way in the NHL, you have Jacob Larson in the system, you have Brandon Montour coming up as well. The good thing about the Ducks is that they have scouted and developed very well. On top of the guys that I just mentioned, you got Max Jones up front, who is now playing his first pro games in the AHL. So even though there's going to be some attrition in the ranks, they do have players coming in the pipeline. And then at that point, it's a matter of how smoothly does the transition go from sort of one generation to another. Yes. It might take a year or two where the Ducks are like, you know, a borderline playoff team or something like that. And maybe they don't get to the level of the Halcyon Getzlaf Perry years. But, I mean, this is the position they're in. And they're going to be a team that, as you said, unless they trade somebody and get something back, they're going to lose a very good player in the expansion draft. And that's kind of like the, you know, the punishment for being well-built.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's a bit of the Chicago syndrome of you pay for your success, but unfortunately they just haven't managed to get over the hump so far. But my worry is more about a guy like Kessler, who's, you know, got a lot of miles and a lot of tough miles on those wheels. And so how much does he have left in the tank if they're not successful this year?
That's the thing. They're early 30s, but they're almost physically, they might be more like 35-year-olds. And I mean, Corey Perry might be 37-year-olds.
Yeah.
They're aging quickly, yes. Right? So I do agree. There might be a step backward and eventually a step forward because they do have those good young prospects, but it's an important year to take their shot. And they're going to lose somebody, and some people are saying it's not going to be Silverberg, but I wrote it down because I want to explain why it's guaranteed they're going to lose someone, okay? You've got Perry has a no-movement clause, Getzlaf no-movement clause, Kessler no-movement clause, so they must be protected. Kevin Bieksa's got a no-movement clause, so he's going to have to agree to waive it to not count, which he might do as a favor to the team, knowing that he ain't getting claimed by this. But because Anaheim's got Vatanen, Lindholm, Fowler, and Mason, that's four defensemen, which means you're going to protect eight skaters, not seven forwards and three defensemen. So if you're protecting eight skaters, you can only protect four forwards if you're doing those four defensemen, which means Perry, Getzlaf, Kessler, Ricard, Raquel. So that leaves out Silverberg and Andrew Cogliano. The only way to solve the problem is you have to trade one of Vatanen, Lindholm, Fowler, or Manson. And if you trade one of those guys, ideally, you might want to trade one for a young forward who's exempt, who's young enough that he doesn't have his service years yet. So let's say you traded Josh Manson to the Leafs for a Kasperi Kapanen or something like that, because Kapanen would be exempt from the expansion rules, I'm pretty sure, based on his service time. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to see Bob Murray pulling off some kind of ingenuity. That's why I think it's going to be really fun. People are talking about how exciting the expansion draft is going to be, but I also think in the window between the Cup final ending and the start of the expansion draft, you're going to see some crazy
trades. No summer vacation for GMs this
year.
Nor
for us. It's going to be a busy June. So it's going to be interesting, and you'd like to think Silverberg is playing his way into their future plans, because he's been a point-per-game player for 3 years in the playoffs.
Yeah.
But you look at those four defensemen. Keeping Silverberg means getting rid of one of those guys, guaranteed. So you have to ask that question.
But what about dealing Silverberg?
Or dealing Silverberg, that's true. Yeah. But do you want to deal him? That's the thing. Like if he's become that indispensable.
Yeah. I mean, if you're gonna if you've decided that you're gonna keep your defensemen, and I'll ask you what you'll do after this. But if you're decided you're gonna keep those guys, why are you gonna risk him for nothing if you can deal him? And even if you're just getting picks and exempt prospects,
it's a great question. That might be the plan B.
Yeah. So you're building version 2 of the Vegas mock draft. For the upcoming issue, what do you have the Ducks doing, and who ends up in Vegas from Anaheim?
Well, it's funny. Right now, it's Silverberg, but Silverberg he had a really good week. Can I resubmit? But so now I'm even questioning it. But right now I do have them losing Silverberg. Yeah. But
we also limited you in your ability in that draft to make trades.
Yeah, the rules for the assignment was no trades, no virtual trades. But right now, I would consider trading Sammy Vatanen, because Vatanen's a power play quarterback, but he's not the most versatile player. He's not very big, and there are a lot of other guys coming up in the Duck system that do the same things Vatanen does, but maybe even better, like Brandon Montour. Shea Theodore is pretty versatile as well. You got Jacob Larson, who's also very mobile, on top of your Fowler, and your Lindholm, who's extremely mobile. I just don't think you need Vatanen's skill set anymore, and I think he's the least versatile. He might have the lowest ceiling of that group now, which is funny. We wouldn't have said that a couple years ago, but he also still has trade value. He's more of a name brand than your Shea Theodores of the world right now. So I think I would explore trading him.
As the prospect expert, Rye, are anybody in their system, would you be confident enough to trade one of their so-called big four and be confident that one of their prospects could step up and fill that void?
I would be, yeah, and that's the way I would try to go 7-3-1 for that reason. I have a lot of faith in Shea Theodore. Mm-hmm. He's getting to see the hard NHL right now, and I think that's really good for him. And I mean, the good thing about Anaheim is that he would be a little bit insulated, because you would still have Lindholm, you would still have Fowler. You don't have to have Shea Theodore playing a top two role. You know, maybe he's your number four. Heck, maybe he's still a 5-6 defenseman next year. That's okay. He's still young. It takes longer for blue liners to make an impact usually in the NHL. So just for him, I think that's fine. And then Montour and Larson, I think there's some nice upside there as well, where, again, if they don't have to do too much right away, then you're putting them in a nice place to develop, and hopefully that gets them on the right track long term.
Let's do some reader questions here. We've got one from Brad Bell via Twitter. He's asking us, does the Canes acquiring Darling make them a wild card team next year? Boy, that's some low expectations.
But in that division,
that's fair.
That's pragmatic, yeah. Because the Metro is like a gauntlet right now.
So, and he says, and also, what would you do with Cam Ward's contract? So it's a two-pronged question, Matt. Take a stab at both.
Okay. Sorry, I'm already laughing at my Cam Ward answer. involves kerosene. Just kidding, Cam Ward. No, I'm not. I think the answer is yes, not necessarily because of Darling, but because Carolina already flirted with wildcard status this year. They're already a team on the rise. I really like what you're seeing from the young blue line, especially Jacob Slavin and Brett Pesce. I'm really impressed with them, and they've almost, I don't want to say surpassed Noah Hanifin, but maybe in the short term, they've become really important pieces of that team. So I do think you're seeing a steady upward trajectory. Carolina obviously needs some more scoring from its forwards. We'll see if they can get it going forward and if they can keep developing guys through the draft. Even a slight uptick in goaltending could be the difference. If Carolina was already within striking distance, had a good second half, and is Darling the answer? I don't know. He was a great backup goalie. I'm still curious, as a goalie who's really big and is not known as the fittest goalie in the NHL, I don't know if he's going to be able to hold up to playing 50 or 60 games. And will his performance be as strong with a bigger sample size? I don't know. But I like Scott Darling. I think he's been a good NHL goalie. And I think he's an upgrade over Cam Ward. So for the second part of the question, I don't know. I think if you're going to shed Cam Ward's contract, it's going to be in a side deal with Vegas where you have to give them a draft pick for Vegas to take the number off your hands, something like that.
Does the lack of long-term sample size from Darling, I mean, he's really just been a backup for 2 years now, 3 years now, and you're throwing $4 million at him. I mean, that's a lot of belief for a guy. Does that worry you at all if you're a Carolina Hurricanes fan?
I'm not too worried about that, particularly since the underlying metrics have been very good with Scott Darling. And I think, you know, this is his time. And, I mean, frankly, the bar's pretty low in Carolina in terms of goaltending, yeah. Right? Like, Scott Darling just has to be, like, pretty decent.
Yeah.
You know? And that's better than Cam Ward and Eddie Lack gave them.
And the upside is he is brilliant, and he ends up eventually being the number one guy who can lead them into a deep playoff run once they develop as a team.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's some really good indicators that Carolina is on the upswing. You look at the rookie season that Sebastian Aho had, particularly his second half was very strong. They still have some nice weapons up front. Justin Falk is the anchor of that defense, and Justin Falk is not that old.
No, he's only like 25.
Yeah. But he's still very good. So that defense, I mean, they're very much in the Nashville mold where they're very mobile and they have a lot of nice weapons and assets back there. They can do a lot of different things. So I think that bodes well for them. They don't have that traditional number one dominant center that you need to, like, contend for a Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where they're going to get that guy, if they can find that guy. But that's a long-term challenge. You can certainly get to the playoffs without that guy. And, you know, Jordan Staal's still got some good hockey in him, even though he's not a number one center at this point.
Maybe not a number two.
He's a good two-way guy.
He's a good two-way guy, yeah.
I think he was fifth on my Selke ballot this year. So he's good, but that's...
Exactly.
You want him... He's a championship-caliber number three center.
Yes.
He literally was a championship number three center.
Right. Exactly.
In Pittsburgh, yeah.
Yeah, and there's enough players surrounding him where they seem to get it done, again, particularly in the second half, where, yeah, maybe their defense is a little more, star-driven than the offense will be next season, but they've got enough of a mix that I think they can certainly contest for a playoff spot.
Matty O asks, and is it any chance that this is Matthias Olund asking? Like, I'm looking at my grainy print-off here, and it kind of looks like Matthias Olin.
Asking for a friend.
Is he? And it would make sense. Matty O is asking, how long before the Canucks are a relevant team
again?
Oh,
and it's a Canucks question.
That's
Matthias Olin.
I'll hang up and listen. Well, Matthias, it's going to be a while. And part of that is I feel they're kind of caught in this situation where, you know, they're bad right now, but they still have the Sedins, so you can't be like tragically bad when you have the Sedins in your lineup, like not Colorado bad. But they're at the point now where they're accruing assets, and there's some nice players to build off. Bo Horvat, Thatcher Demko, Brock Besser, Troy Stetcher, you know, they've got some nice options, and they've got them at all the right positions. I think Bo Horvat in particular has shown just how good he can be. Mm-hmm. Having said that, you still need to fill it out, and you still have to have guys that are playing next season and playing prominent roles. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see them trade somebody who's highly in demand, i.e. Chris Tanev, who's very much a very good player now. But by the time Vancouver got better, he would start being on the decline, and that's just smart building. So you probably see Tanev gone, so they're not going to get much traction next year, I would not suppose. So I think, you know, they kind of got some bad luck in that they lost the draft lottery. But even saying that, it's not a great year for the draft. So maybe what we see is, I mean, maybe the Canucks get the number one pick next season or even the number two pick, and you get a Rasmus Dahlin or an Andrei Svechnikov, two guys who certainly look like they can be game breakers already. Even Joseph Valeno with St. John, another player with a pretty high ceiling. That would really help the Canucks. So I think what you're looking at is at least a couple years down the road when all the building that you've started doing now starts to pay off.
At this point, if you're a Canucks fan, you pray for losses. Because if you've seen what's happened in Toronto and if you've seen what happens in Edmonton, to me, it's a Stars game. And nothing will vault you back up more quicker than getting a star in your lineup. And the easiest way to do that, obviously, is to hit a home run by getting a high draft pick. Matt, my question for you, do the Sedins finish next year in Vancouver Canuck uniforms?
Oh boy, I don't think they should, but I think they will. The vibe I get from them, based on the types of things you hear them say in yearly exit interviews, they sound very Chris Phillips-like or Shane Doan-like, where I think they're comfortable, they don't want to leave, which is, I think, it's a shame for them and for the Canucks, in my opinion. It kind of reminds me of when Matt Sundin had the original opportunity to go via trade and Leaf fans were up in arms, the Muskoka 5 situation where the Sedins are sort of this anchor and they're holding the team back, and it sounds funny because it's like they actually need to sink more. So this is a bad metaphor because I think they need to remove the Sedins to sink more. But what my point is that the Sedins are preventing the Canucks from bottoming out right now. And if you can trade them, you bottom out because your team's just far less competitive. But it's a complicated situation to work out in a trade because they're going to want to go together, I'm sure. It won't be easy to do. It would be exciting to see them traded together or even traded separately. That would be really fun. Oh, yeah. But I don't get the vibe that they're going to want to go. And that's going to prevent the Canucks from getting very good assets from them in a trade. And it's just going to, you know, they're not what they were, but they're still pretty good players. They're probably going to add 4 wins to the team next year, which could be the difference between winning and not winning the lottery.
100%. This is the first time I'm going to say this. I wish Ken was here because I want to hear the grown men, why can't they go play on separate teams rant. That's one of my favorite Ken rants. So.
Here's my conspiracy theory. The Sedins play out their Vancouver contract, then they go back to Sweden and play for hometown Modo.
Yeah, that to me makes a lot of sense. And I get that same vibe, that they aren't really interested in moving on. You know, they like the Vancouver team. It's funny, what is actually a noble thing to not abandon your team is somehow seen as a slight against
you. Bastards.
Yeah. All right.
How dare you stick with us through thick and thin?
I more just want to grab them and shake them because I just want to say, you're a pro athlete. Don't you want to win?
Yes,
don't absolutely. You want to win? You can leave your family for a couple months and stay in hotel rooms, FaceTime them every night if you have to. Win the cup. Come on.
You've also got family with you if you get traded together.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
I don't disagree. Anyways, let's take one more reader question here. We've got one from Ryan, who asks, who could you see wearing a Flames jersey next year? Ranta, Fleury, or Korpisalo?
I don't think Ranta or Korpisalo, because I think there's a great chance both will be claimed in the expansion draft. I think Ranta is as likely as any goaltender to be claimed in the expansion draft. Only $1 million salary, 1 year left on his deal. He will be exposed because Lundqvist will be protected. He's a great claim, in my opinion.
Big time upside.
Big time upside. So to me, Fleury and the Flames are a great marriage right now, because we know Fleury's going to want a chance to start. He's shown it in these playoffs. He's still capable. It's not a massive investment. It's much cheaper than Ben Bishop because of the term. It's going to be only 2 more years of Fleury, so that element of it is attractive. And the Flames, we know they were in on Bishop and they missed, so the next best guy to get is Fleury, and I think that's a deal that has to happen.
Assuming it is Fleury, and I assume you feel the same way.
I do.
Where does that put them in the Pacific if they acquire Fleury?
I think it puts them pretty high, but not the highest. I think if I was to handicap the Pacific for next season right now, you got Edmonton number one. Mm-hmm. And then it's probably some iteration of either San Jose, Anaheim, or Calgary.
Yeah.
I think depending on what the Sharks do with like Joe Thornton and Patrick Marleau, depending on how well or not well the Ducks age, and then frankly, if it's Fleury, how well does he play in Calgary?
Totally.
You
know? It's a completely different ballgame playing in Calgary than it is playing in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. You got different opponents, you got a different defense core, different style of play with the team in front of you. It'll be interesting, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, thanks very much to everybody who sent in questions. Sorry we couldn't get them to all of them today. And a big thank you, of course, to Ryan and Matt for taking their time to appear on the podcast today. And, of course, thank you to everybody out there for listening. We'll see you again next week.